to another episode of the Glenn and Helen Show. It's all about alternative technologies today. First, we're talking to Popular Mechanics editor Jim Miggs about ethanol, methanol, biodiesel, hydrogen, and other alternative fuels.
Then we'll talk to Henry Copeland of blogads.com about his new reader survey and the future of the blogosphere. But first, we've got Jim Miggs on the phone now.
Gas prices are high and people are interested in alternative fuels. And it's not just the granola types. One of my best friends, who's a longtime farmer, a lifelong Republican, and a gun owner, is now running his pickup truck on biodiesel. He's proud of it, too. I'm driving a hybrid. And lots of other people are interested in alternatives to gasoline. Popular Mechanics magazine recently surveyed alternative fuels, and we've got Jim Miggs, editor-in-chief of Popular Mechanics, on the phone to talk about what he found. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Glenn. Hello, Helen.
Hey, Jim. How are you doing?
Just fine.
Good. First question is, can I start running my car on methanol tomorrow, and should I?
Not methanol. You really need to make a lot of changes in the engine, in the car, in the whole fuel system to run fuels like methanol. And I think that one of the real practicalities or impracticalities of these alternative fuels that not everyone has taken into account is the major changes in the infrastructure we need to make. For example, if you want to handle methanol or ethanol in your car's fuel system, anything made of plastic or rubber needs to be replaced with the right kind of materials that won't break down with these really very powerful solvents. So there is some expense involved. Obviously, the cars that are designed for, say, E85, the ethanol blends are made with this, taking this into account, but you can't convert a regular car over that easily.
How would you convert it?
Well, I mean, if you have a gasoline-powered car and you say, well, I want to run on, you know, 85% ethanol or methanol, you'd need to replace a lot of the fuel system. And by the time you've done that, the cost advantage, if any, would be really pretty impractical.
Might as well just buy a new car.
That's right.
Well, if there's not much reason to go with methanol or ethanol too quickly, what other alternatives look good?
Well, I'm not saying that these alternatives don't have their place, but I think that what we're really looking for toward is a gradual transition towards say, flex fuel vehicles, where the car could run on ordinary gasoline, it could run on E85 ethanol, possibly methanol, and there's a lot of some of these vehicles are really coming down the pike right now. So the first question is really the vehicle. The next question is the infrastructure to deliver the fuel into the field so you can get it conveniently. And then the final question is, does this really make both economic sense and national policy sense? And what we found in our story is that there really isn't a silver bullet out there. There's a whole range of alternative fuels. They have pros and cons. They all have some promise, but there's no easy solution. And one thing that we're really struck by is there seems to be a lot of wishful thinking when you talk to people who say, well, we should just convert everything over to ethanol like they do in Brazil. Or you know, I got a friend who runs his car on French fry oil. And that's true. And you can do that. It's kind of a cool project. But there isn't that much French fry oil out here to replace all the imported oil that we use or to really make much of a dent in our consumption of gasoline right now.
Yeah, I think you said when we talked about this before that you come away from all these looks at alternative fuel with a lot of added respect for gasoline.
That's for sure. I mean, to have a compact fuel that's easy to transport, that has a lot of energy per gallon, and, you know, as environmentally destructive as it might be out the tailpipe, getting oil out of the ground and into your car is a relatively clean process today. I mean, major oil spills, let's hope, are a thing of the past. And so they've definitely made a lot of progress in that area. There's the political question of sending all this money overseas to various, you know, terrorist-supporting or totalitarian governments. But the question from in terms of just the practicality, it makes you realize how hard it is to replace that that fuel. There isn't any one alternative today that is a lot more practical.
Yeah, I noticed President Bush was talking about ethanol and corn. And one question, I don't know if you looked at this in your study or not, is I think it takes a lot of actually energy to grow corn? And is it a net gain?
That's a big debate. And I had went into this thinking it's a net loss. But as we went into it, the Department of Energy has actually studied this a good deal. And they determined that depending on how you measure all the factors, it is a net gain. Some studies say 30%, some studies say 60%. But let's say it is, let's say it's 50%. That's still not that much. I mean, you're putting a gallon of oil into the process to get the equivalent of half a gallon of oil back out at the end. I mean, or a gallon and a half of oil out at the end of the process. Also, you have to take into account farming corn is, it's an intensive process. I mean, you've got fertilizer and pesticide runoff and tractors and trucks and lots of transportation. I mean, it's from an environmental point of view, it's pretty hard on the environment, although we all love to see cornfields and farms. But if you were going to start from scratch and say, what's the most environmentally friendly way to collect energy for a car, you know, it's not the most practical approach. We happen to have tons of corn grown in this country and big corn surpluses, so farmers are thrilled to see corn kind of pushed as far as the line as an alternative fuel. But there's a heavy element of subsidizing farms here, not just pure energy policy.
Yeah, it's obvious why a corn farmer likes the idea of ethanol from corn, but not so much for the rest of us. You looked also at hydrogen power, and of course the great thing about hydrogen is that when you burn hydrogen, the exhaust is just water. There's no greenhouse impact. There's no toxicity at all, really. What's the problem with hydrogen fuel?
Well, there are quite a few, unfortunately. I mean, hydrogen is the holy grail. You know, it's completely environmentally neutral out the tailpipe. The question is, where do you get the hydrogen? And it takes a lot of energy to separate the, you know, oxygen and hydrogen in water. So you're going to be either using a lot of electricity or some form of energy to get the hydrogen. There are some other, on the horizon, there's some really cool technologies to yield hydrogen. One is a really neat system. We actually gave an award to the engineers who invented this to separate hydrogen from sewage and other waste products. So that's exciting, but we're talking small quantities for the foreseeable future. One of the things we did in our article is we calculated what it would cost today to drive coast to coast with each of these alternative fuels. And it would cost about, we did this a month or so ago when the price was a little lower. We figured it cost about $212 on gasoline in a Honda Civic. Today that would probably be $270 or something. It would cost $800 to drive cross country using a hydrogen fuel cell vehicle. So, you know, clearly we've got a big gap to fill in terms of the price. There's another issue too. Fuel cells are one way to use hydrogen. If you want to use hydrogen as an internal combustion fuel, you know, hydrogen is hard to store. I mean, you either have to compress it like crazy or you have to freeze it down to more than 400 below zero. So even though the hydrogen itself is the simplest atom in the universe and the most plentiful, it's pretty tricky to handle here on the surface of Earth and not that easy to obtain. So we think this is the answer someday, but it might be another 20 years or more before hydrogen is a frequent fuel source, unless we come up with some extremely cheap, environmentally friendly source of electricity to make all that hydrogen.
Well, what about electricity? Your article didn't look at hybrids and plug-in hybrids, but you've read about those before. Are they worth the money?
Well, we're a big fan of hybrids in general, and as you know from our last interview, we're kind of pushing back against some of this new hybrid skepticism. A lot of people, I think, are there's this backlash against hybrids from people who don't necessarily fully understand the point of the technology. Plug-in hybrids actually, we think, do have promise. One thing that surprised me in our study was just how cheap electricity is. In that thing I told you about driving coast to coast, it would cost $60. To drive coast to coast in an electric car. Obviously, you know, it would take a while. You have to stop and plug it in pretty often. But, the cost of electricity is about 2 cents a mile for an electric car. So if you take a hybrid and you have the dependability of that gasoline engine, so you're not going to get stranded somewhere, but you supplement it with a plug-in overnight, which incidentally is when the electric rates are low and the electric companies are looking for a place to put all that power. You can't just turn down an electric generating plant at night so easily. So, So that off-peak power is actually in ample supply. So you, if you can increase the battery capacity of the hybrid and have a plug-in function, you could, you know, you could easily get a car that around town almost never runs, almost never engage that gasoline engine. You just run the batteries, and then you take a longer trip and use your gasoline engine. There are a lot of some individuals are kind of hacking their hybrids to do this. Other automotive companies and research organizations are looking into this. I think we'll see quite a few of these in just in a few years. I think it's a pretty smart answer, and I was kind of surprised by that because I've been skeptical about the fact that, you know, even electricity has to come from somewhere, and somewhere somebody's burning coal to generate it, and yet it seems that the that even from an environmental point of view, the impact is not as bad as you know, burning gasoline in the first place.
Yeah, I really, you know, was reading about some of the plug-in hybrids, and even the not terribly impressive ones. You know, you're talking 50 miles of range on battery, and that's more than enough for me to do my daily commute and errands and basically never run the gas engine except when I'm on a trip.
That's right. And I think, you know, I think there's really something to this, and I think that what we're coming away thinking is that the hunt for one solution may be sort of narrow-minded, or that the government needs to step in and put its chips on a particular technology. That would worry me. My feeling is that the market's going to continue to push a variety of alternatives that that, you know, no one individually is going to solve this problem, but collectively they're going to make a dent. I don't think we're going to see massive reductions or the end of oil or imported oil anytime soon, but I do think that there are there's lots of progress being made, and of course, you know, as hard as these high prices are on everybody, there's certainly a major spur both for manufacturers and for consumers to look for alternatives.
So what comes next? You're going to do an article on extracting oil from the Alberta tar sands, or something on coal?
As a matter of fact, yeah, we're doing a big report on all the major energy sources and what the next is in these technologies. I mean, after all, coal, we have hundreds of years worth of coal. It's pretty bad stuff when you burn it, but there are ways to get the energy out of that coal without necessarily burning it. And so, you know, we'll be looking into that. We're also looking into, right now we're working on basically engineering the 100-mile-per-gallon car, what that would take. It probably wouldn't be a car any of us would want to drive around in every day, but it is possible. I mean, we constantly hear people say, well, why can't they make a – I heard somebody on CNN the other day say, well, why don't they make an SUV that gets 50 miles to the gallon? And our take is, well, because you're driving around in a 5,000-pound car, if you want to get 50 miles to the gallon, you're going to have to up the weight, lose the air conditioning, lose the leather seat, and accept a lot less vehicle if you're really going to make that a priority. But it can be done. You could make a car that gets 100 miles to the gallon.
Well, the next time you start do one of your debunking issues, I want you to do one on the perennial myth that there are secret patents for 100-mile-per-gallon carburetors that Detroit is suppressing. I've been hearing that since I was a kid.
Well, actually, I've got one in my drawer under lock and key. I mean, I'm not supposed to let anybody see it. But, you know, it's funny. Last summer we did a test of a lot of these gadgets. There's that idea that somebody invented this thing back in the 50s, and the oil companies, you know, wouldn't let them sell it. The other one is, you know, if you look on the net and stuff, you can find all these gadgets that supposedly boost your mileage dramatically. And so we actually tested a bunch of them last summer and found out that, well, you know, they either at best they don't work, at worst one of them set the engine on fire. You know, the idea that that all these car makers around the world somehow wouldn't pursue a technology that would immediately make them the most successful automotive manufacturer in the world is a little hard for me to believe. But on the other hand, I'm not somebody who sees a conspiracy under every rose bush out there.
So. Do you think Americans expect too much? I mean, do you think that's part of it, the psychological sort of the culture of just expecting a lot?
You know, I do sometimes. And I really feel that our mass culture, media, news, entertainment culture really promotes that kind of thinking too. This sort of
almost like magical thinking.
I was talking about Bill O'Reilly the other day. This kind of easy populism. Like it's always why don't they do something? What's going on? Why can't they?
They're trying to keep it from me. They're trying to keep it from me. I think people have this attitude.
Right. Or, you know, you hear a lot right now, people saying, well, you know, if the car companies had made high mileage cars, that, you know, if they hadn't been so busy making SUVs, the fact is, in the early 90s, they were making a lot of high mileage cars. I mean, look at GM. They had the whole standard division, mostly small, relatively efficient cars. People weren't buying them. Gas prices were incredibly low. Everybody was out buying Ford Expeditions. And now people are turning around saying, why did you sell me this car? You can't totally blame the manufacturers for selling people the cars that people were buying. And at some point, consumers do have to take some responsibility for their own choices. That's not to say there aren't smart things that the car companies could be or should be doing, and there aren't good policies the government could be enacting. But individuals do have some control over their own fate. You don't have to drive around in a 5,000-pound vehicle if you don't want to be spending $60 to fill it up.
Well, my sense is people aren't really feeling the pain all that much, because when I go on the interstate, they don't seem to have slowed down at all.
Isn't that interesting? And, you know, it's funny, the sales of certain SUVs like the Cadillac Escalade are continuing to go up.
Well, you know, gasoline is actually historically not at a tremendous high. And I think, you know, a lot of people, I mean, if you're going to spend $50,000 or $60,000 on a car, the gas expense is not the biggest part of it.
That's right. The incremental expense on top of your cost per mile, it don't, you know, a huge increase in the price of gas only adds a couple of cents to your cost per mile once, you know, on top of your lease and everything else. I don't think people are necessarily looking at it that way, though. They're looking at that, you know, $50 they're shelling out every time they fill up. And you know, it's natural people are upset by that.
Well, I think the whole car industry is based on people not realizing what their true cost per mile is.
You know, I think that's true, and I think that people, a lot of times, you know, they spend money they don't necessarily need to spend, but most of us, you know, we love our cars, and, like, you could argue with your hybrid, you spent a lot more than you needed to on that vehicle, and, you know, you're not necessarily saving that money tomorrow in gasoline, but you could argue that people spend money on high-performance cars that can go a lot faster than you're ever going to drive that car, or cars that have technology you appreciate even though you rarely or never use it. I think a hybrid that delivers some great performance as well as efficiency is maybe one of those purchases that you're willing to spend the money partly for psychological reasons, not just for practical reasons.
I think that's right. So no big breakthroughs on the horizon. They're going to solve all our problems. We're just going to have to, like, live with the real world and the laws of physics and stuff.
You know, the laws of physics, the second law of thermodynamics has not been rescinded yet.
I hate that.
So a lot of people seem to think that ought to be within President Bush's power. We haven't seen any sign of that yet.
Well, maybe Bill O'Reilly and Lou Dobbs can do it if Bush can't.
I think if they just yell enough, and you know, that's it, they might have some.
It'll happen tomorrow.
Although then there's global warming to consider.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Okay, talk to you soon.
Bye.
I wish we could repeal the laws of physics.
I wish we had politicians and pundits who realize we can't.
Now we're going from alternative fuels to alternative media. We're on the phone with Henry Copeland of blogads.com. He's the man who's got his finger on the pulse of the blogosphere.
We'll ask him about what he's found, what trends he sees, and what may come next. It's nice to have you here, Henry.
My pleasure. Great to be with you guys.
Hey, Henry. Our first question is, we always hear that the typical blog reader is either some teenage girl or some loser guy living in his parents' basement. The surveys really don't bear that out, do they?
Not at all. I mean, if you were to survey the right group of folks, you probably would find that. If you were to survey MySpace or Zangin, you'd probably find the teenage girls. But when, you know, the political journalists are writing about blogs these days, they're really writing about a very sober group of people, amazingly sober. I mean, we did not actually do any surveys about how much beer people drank or homebrew, but, you know, people in their 40s and 50s, people making $80,000, $90,000, $100,000, people who are intense consumers of media, not at all. I mean, really the antithesis of the slacker crowd.
Tell us about your survey. How do you decide who to poll or how to poll?
We get in touch with all of the big bloggers in a particular sphere, all the folks who either from our traffic or from other people's traffic statistics look like, you know, folks who are important players, and we say, hey, we're doing this survey, we've done it now, this is the third year, would you like to participate? In prior years, we've dumped everybody into one landing page, and this year we realized, gee, we should actually be asking the different spheres vaguely different questions, kind of tailored to the interests of the different spheres. So this year we asked the political bloggers to send their readers to one specific page that was politically focused, and then gossip bloggers to another page, mommy bloggers to another page, and then music bloggers to a fourth page.
And what did you find that was unique about, say, the demographics of political bloggers?
Well, the political bloggers are a good 20 years older than, say, the mommy bloggers or the music bloggers or the gossip bloggers in all those cases. I mean, you know, Glenn's readers are 45, probably is the mean for Glenn's readers, and your typical mommy or music or gossip bloggers down in the mid-20s. The music bloggers would tend to be very male, but the gossip and the mommy bloggers are all, you know, 90% women.
So women do actually get on the web. It's just that they like different areas.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
People are really attracted to different information. I mean, I see this all the time when I go out and am doing presentations to folks, and I start out the presentation by saying, well, you know, who in the audience read blogs? And then I say, well, you know, what do you read? And very definitely, if you're talking to women, they're going to tell you they read Perez Hilton. If you're talking to men, they're going to say they're reading Instapundit, Daily Coast, those types of blogs.
What percentage of men read the political blogs then?
Well, you know, this the one problem with our survey, you ask a good question. What we know only is the people who responded, and we don't know the people who didn't respond. You know, we can hear the sound of one hand clapping. We can hear who applauds, but who doesn't applaud. We know that among respondents, it was 80% male in the political blog. So it's very, very strongly male.
Yeah, I remember I filled one of those out, and the political ones. I found it really interesting to take that survey.
So you're not reading the gossip blogs?
I don't read gossip blogs. No, I only do political blogs. I have no interest in the gossip blogs, but apparently a lot of people do.
Well, you should check them out. I mean, a guy like Perez Hilton has created this whole new universe for himself. He's got his kind of a faux identity, and he's now hanging out with the celebrities. So it's something, it's kind of a new twist on blogging.
Well, do you see blog readership growing overall, or has it leveled out?
It's definitely growing. I mean, there are two things to distinguish here. One is when you look at the Technorati surveys, you see these, you know, monstrous growth. Gee, it's doubling every 6 months, both in terms of number of bloggers and in terms of number of blog readers. I actually think those numbers are a little bit distorted because, you know, it's like saying how many people in America speak French. Well, a third of the people in America took high school French, but they don't actually speak French. And I think almost everybody at this point who's literate has gone into Blogger and created themselves a blog. But, you know, in terms of really committed readers and writers and stuff, it's clearly, it's a pretty unique and weird group of people. You know, there are a very finite number of people out there who care enough about politics to spend 10 hours a week reading political blogs the way, you know, for instance, your readers do, Glenn. You know, you've got to agree that it's only, you know, A, to have the time, and B, to have the interest to really geek out on the political insider stuff, on the opinion stuff.
Yeah, the blogs sort of filter for intensity of interest in a way that mass media don't.
Yeah, very definitely. It's a very, it's a rarefied audience. And so while I think all of you guys, the politically focused guys, will continue to grow, I do not think the sky's limit. I mean, I think ultimately, you know, no more than 5% of the total media consuming public ultimately, you know, has the level, you know, the intensity of commitment and the intensity of interest to actually go back day after day after day and you know, form the core audience for these things.
Well, what about some of the new multimedia efforts we see? Michelle Malkin has this video thing, Hot Air, and of course there are podcasts like this one. Do you see advertisers moving to these areas? I mean, so far I don't see a whole lot of movement that way, but do you think it'll happen sooner rather than later?
I think, you know, it's an interesting question. There's a sense in which, you know, it's a big leap from selling ads in newspapers to selling ads online. And it's also a big leap from selling ads online to then putting them in the blogs. Because, again, the blog audience are very different. The approach is different. The way you want to connect with them is different. On the other hand, the traditional multimedia stuff, it's a relatively small leap from selling radio ads to splicing ads into podcasts. I mean, there are problems in terms of how do you keep track of it all, but, you know, audio is audio. And if you're used to doing it in one place, you can do it in another place. The same would go for video. So I think we're actually going to see video and audio ads move faster than we've seen. It's taken 10 years for online advertising to reach the point that it's at, you know, almost 15 years, let's say. Whereas the video and the audio stuff is going to happen a lot faster. That said, I think it's going to tend to be the incumbents who dominate. Because those folks, you know, they've got the sales forces in place, they can create the content. It's not for nothing that most of the biggest players, on iTunes in terms of podcasts are traditional, conventional players. The incumbent media. I'd love to hear what you think about that. I mean, this is your podcast. How do you see it working out?
Yeah, I don't know what I think. I mean, I think one thing that struck me actually is, I think the iTunes charts are kind of iffy because they really measure new subscribers.
Okay.
But I've noticed that, you know, people like us or like Powerline, come on and move very high in the charts very fast. So I think there's a lot of mobility, and it's certainly a growing area. So my sense is that one of the things that struck me about your survey was that so few people who responded had listened to a podcast. And I was actually guessing that if you ran that survey again now, you'd see a fairly dramatic increase in the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's on a very rapid growth phase right now.
Well, the one other point I make about the media consumption, the beautiful thing about blogs is they're competing in this vast, virgin territory of the workday. Basically people get into the office at 9 o'clock, they go home at 5 o'clock, and they've got 2 or 3 hours in the middle of the day when they're sitting at the computers on a broadband connection, and they, you know, unless they really love their job or are really well watched, they can be sitting there reading blogs. And
so what you're saying is people dislike their job so much that they'd rather just get on and start reading blogs?
You look at our servers, and it's an amazing thing, and I'm sure you know your server log is the same thing, which is, 8:30 in the morning,
Right. Traffic
starts to kick up, it peaks around noon, it runs high through 3 o'clock, and then as, folks start to go home in L.A., it finally, heads back down. Now, podcasting, I just don't see when people can consume this stuff.
Well, what's interesting to us is that we find we get the most downloads sometimes on the weekends, which I guess makes sense since people have to actually download it onto maybe their, onto their iPod. It may take more time. They may have to do it at home.
Well, and that would be, and you just can't sit there at your desk and consume.
Right.
Right.
And you really can't do the same thing for video. I mean, you can, you can watch the stuff surreptitiously, but, folks can sit there. I mean, very clearly, if people are reading, the median reader of political blogs is reading 10 hours a week. And I would bet you that just, they don't really read it at home. They're reading 2 hours per workday.
I think we're doing more than the Federal Reserve to keep the U.S. economy from spinning out of control.
There you go. There you go.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that, blogs are built around procrastination in the workplace. And podcasting isn't, our readers or listeners say they like to listen to them in the car when they commute.
Yep.
They like to listen to them when they work out, which among other things means they tend to like them to be comparatively long.
Huh.
Typical radio shows, you want it to be short and punchy because you figure people are going to change channels. And it's a little different aesthetic, I think.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really important point. Is it very different? I mean, there's a lot. We run into this question a lot. People are like, bloggers all use RSS, therefore blogging and RSS are synonymous, or podcasting and RSS, blogs are all synonymous. No, it just happens that this is an early adopter audience. You guys have gotten into both. You're ahead of the curve, but I think in the long run, we're going to end up with very distinct sets of players. The podcasters are, it's going to be a different mentality. It's going to be a different art form. There will be some people that are successful in both. But in general, you know, there's going to be different audiences, different times of consumption, different modes of consumption, and ultimately, I think, different sets of ads and different types of advertisers that it works well for.
Do you want to get into advertising on podcasts? Have you thought of that?
Yeah, Blog Ads 3.0, which we're currently bug testing, which is a joy, having worked on it for 18 months, lays the foundation for selling multiple different ad formats. And that would mean not only in terms of pixel size and, you know, numbers of links, but, you know, in other formats. So if somebody has something for sale, basically they can put it up for sale with us.
Mm-hmm.
And again, to the degree that we do get people coming to us and saying, gee, I want to buy ads on podcasts, then that's nice. I mean, I kind of dread it because, God forbid, you know, just keeping up with the whole thing, monitoring all of it. I'm not sure how anybody's actually going to be able to tell, okay, yes, it was downloaded to 10,000 iPods, but how many people actually listen to the whole thing?
Right.
That's going to be.
But then again, there's a comparison with a book. Say somebody buys a book, do you really know they read it?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a thing.
Yep.
Well, before we go, because we're nearly out of time.
Wow.
What advice do you give people? I get these emails all the time, so you probably do too. People who say, I want to start a blog and make money. What advice do you have?
Go, you know, unless you have a brilliant voice, a unique voice, and some people do, but most people have some special knowledge or some special passion. They may not be the best writers, but they have a really unique sense of what's going on in a certain area. And I think there's still vast unexplored niches, you know, and it may just be a very strong focus on your hometown. It may be a very strong focus on, you know, bear hunting in Western North Carolina or bear, you know, God knows, is there a great bear hunting blog? I know one up in Maine. But you dig really, really hard into that and then be patient. Because it may be 1, 2, 3, 4 years before you develop a sufficient audience that somebody will pay you for it. So, I mean, you know, patience and passion, I would, you know, the two P's would be what I would tell people. And that, nobody wants to hear that.
I mean,
what do you tell them?
That's pretty much what I tell them. They always want to just say, well, I started blogging last week, so shouldn't I be making 6 figures by now?
There you go.
How many people do you have in blog ads? I mean, how many bloggers would you say are involved?
We have 1,100.
Wow.
Of which I would really count maybe 300 as being the very biggest and the very best. And then the rest of those folks have, you know, very interesting niches that perhaps have not yet developed into blogospheres per se. I mean, our favorite folks to work with exist within a nest or a hive or a swarm of other bloggers who are kind of pursuing the same subject. And that's nice because then you can, you know, no advertiser wants to be on just one or two blogs. They really like to be able to buy a certain quantity of and a certain community. And so really our focus now is on kind of building out those smaller communities and helping them to become commercially viable. I mean, that's a, you know, the biggest focus is making more money for the folks we're already working with, but the second focus is to help the other folks become commercially viable.
Has the blogosphere gotten too commercialized?
Good question. Well, you know, even Jason Kotke, who for a long time swore he'd never take ads, and, you know, even now he's got a 40 pixel by 40 pixel, what he calls an ad unit. Other folks would call it a postage stamp. So I guess if Jason Kotke sold out, we're really all in trouble. I don't know, Glenn. I love the fact that, as you put it, the home brewers can actually make money doing something they really, really love. And I'm glad that there are now scores of people who are supporting themselves through blogging. And I would love to see, you know, if there are a few dozen now who can really, you know, pay the rent and put gas in the car, blogging. I'd love to see that be, you know, a couple thousand in, you know, a few years. Now, that doesn't sound like much, but there are only 50,000 daily journalists in the state. So if we can get to the point where there are 5,000 folks actually supporting themselves full-time this way, then that'll be a huge step forward.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you for inviting me.
enjoy having blog ads on my site.
And, you know, you've sold your DVDs for your movie 6 through blog ads, too.
Yeah, that's done pretty well.
Well, we hope this podcast went well for you. We'll be back with another one whenever we feel like it. You can stay tuned for new episodes by checking our blogs at instapundit.com or drhelen.blogspot.com. And you can always subscribe via iTunes. We like that. Until we're back, have fun on the Internet.
Talk to you next time.